From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. This week, Florida became the 36th state in the U.S. to recognize same-sex marriages. A federal judge ruled last year that the state's ban on same-sex marriage violates equal protection and due process requirements in the U.S. Constitution. A stay on that ruling was lifted Tuesday, opening the door to gay couples seeking marriage licenses in all 67 counties in the state. Supporters celebrate the decision as a major step toward equality for gay and lesbian Floridians. Opponents argue the court ruling contradicts the will of voters who approved a constitutional amendment in 2008 defining marriage as between one man and one woman. Plus, this week marks the 30th annual Everglades Coalition Conference in Key Largo. We'll hear from conference organizers and participants about the current health of the Everglades and opportunities and challenges for future restoration. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. This week marks the 30th annual Everglades Coalition Conference. This year's event in Key Largo runs from January 8th through the 11th. The theme of the conference is Send It South. Water for America's Everglades. It brings together a variety of stakeholders, including scientists, policy experts, environmental advocates, and elected officials. Through a variety of featured speakers, panel discussions, and breakout sessions, participants will take a closer look at the current state of the health of the Everglades and the preservation and restoration efforts needed as we begin 2015. Topics will include a broad spectrum of challenges, including sea level rise, nutrient pollution, energy production, and others. The coalition will also unveil its priorities and vision for Everglades restoration efforts in the coming year. Joining me now for a more detailed discussion of the conference and the future of Everglades restoration is Kara Kapp. She's the national co-chair of this year's conference and the Everglades Restoration Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association. Kara, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in studio, we have Jennifer Hecker. She's the Director of Natural Resource Policy for the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and a past co-chair of the conference. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Dawn Sheriffs. She's Senior Everglades Policy Advisor for the Everglades Foundation. Thanks for your time as well.
Thanks for having me, John.
And I invite listeners to join our conversation. You can join us with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments or questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or follow the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive, or you can follow what's coming out of the conference itself on Twitter with hashtag EVCO2015. And Kara, let's begin with you. About how many people do you think you expect to convene on Key Largo for the conference?
About 300 people are headed down to Key Largo this week, so it should be an excellent gathering here.
All right. And I mentioned the theme is Send It South, Water for America's Everglades. I wanted to ask why that theme was chosen, because it sounds like, in a way, that's kind of the underlying theme for most all Everglades restoration efforts.
It is, and in particular this year, we're really focused on sending it south because it's what's necessary for every different region within the Everglades ecosystem. The coastal estuaries need to have that water redirected south so that they're not inundated with polluted flow. Everglades National Park is parched for water. So really the solution to many of our state's water quality problems is to redirect that water south.
And Jennifer Hecker, I know this is a mouthful, and we could probably spend a whole hour just answering this one question, but just as kind of an overview for maybe folks who aren't too familiar, can you explain a little bit about the natural hydrology of the greater Everglades ecosystem and how we've altered it and what the impacts have been?
Sure. So the historic Everglades ranged from Shingle Creek north of Orlando all the way down through the Kissimmee Valley into Lake Okeechobee and then spilled south. We have altered that hydrology by essentially creating a levee around Lake Okeechobee, diverting flow that used to historically go south out, as Kara said, to the St. Lucie Rivers and the Coosahatchee, and then blocking that flow to the south by having this large area known as the Everglades Agricultural Area. And this coming year, we have an option, a chance to buy some of those critical lands needed to restore flow south, but that option expires in October. So I think that's even more pertinent as to why we want to have that theme this year.
And this goes back to the Florida Forever program under the Governor Chris administration, correct? There was a lot of land on the table at one point.
Absolutely. And Chris started buying it, and we were hopeful that that would continue. We are now asking the current administration to finish what we started, get the rest of the U.S. sugar lands into public ownership so we can build a bigger conveyance to redirect these flows.
How would you characterize, I guess, from a legislative end, a commitment to Everglades restoration, you know, going back to the early days of the Crist administration compared to where we are now?
Well, we have enjoyed strong bipartisan support historically, and we are still having some support, but we would like to see that increase. We are always reaching out. We're very pleased that we're going to have many state and federal legislators attending the conference and from both sides. You know, this is really an issue that should be nonpartisan. Everyone should get behind restoring the Everglades because 1 in 3 Floridians gets their water from the Everglades. So it's something that really affects every community in Central and South Florida, and we're hopeful that it'll continue to build momentum and we'll get the restoration done.
And what about Amendment 1, that was adopted by voters just this past November? It actually sets aside a dedicated funding source, looking forward a couple decades. And this is from real estate transaction fees that the state already collects. And then that money goes specifically towards water and land conservation efforts. Could this be a considerable sum of money? Is this a real boon for Everglades restoration, potentially?
Absolutely. We are hopeful that it will restore Everglades restoration funding back to its historic levels so that we'll have a consistent stream of dedicated revenue for that purpose. It's very important when you're planning and trying to execute projects that are multi-year projects that you have that continuous stream of funding. And we've had to deal with, you know, very varying amounts of funding through the years. And we're hopeful that this will make it more consistent, more predictable.
All right. And do we know yet what that money would be allocated towards? Or again, is that something legislators will need to work out in the session in March?
I think that's one of the big challenges ahead is making sure that we have implementing legislation that really carries out the voters' intent with how that money was supposed to be used. And we're already working on providing some direction. The Everglades Coalition community is talking about the recommendations we want to give our legislature as to how they can do that. So I think that's really to be worked out this coming session, and we'll have to wait and see.
And as far as the conference goes, Jennifer Hecker, I understand you're going to be sitting on a panel in this regards impacts of expanded oil drilling. Can you give us an overview on what we've experienced so far in regards to oil drilling, exploration, and impacts or potential impacts on the Everglades?
So almost exactly a year ago, we had a new type of extraction take place in Florida. We've had oil drilling for decades, but this new fracking-like extreme extraction has not been in our state, and we have very unique geology and hydrology here in Florida. We're very concerned the amount of water that's necessary for these new techniques from our fresh, prime, potable water sources. It's an enormous user of water. It creates a lot of potential for contamination of public water supplies, and then there's a wastewater component that has to be dealt with. And that waste has to be disposed of. So, you know, we are looking at this in the context of Everglades restoration and how that could threaten to undermine restoration efforts in trying to restore the hydrology and increase our water supply for the human population and for the natural environment here.
Right. And back at the end of 2013, I remember the Dan A. Hughes Company was found to have performed this oil extraction method similar to fracking. Again, they were not authorized to do that. But that was more than a year ago. Is that kind of, you know, fracking-like oil extraction technique going on elsewhere besides the Collier Hogan well near Lake Trafford?
Well, there hasn't been, because of the controversy that ensued, there hasn't been any attempts to do it since. But we certainly have nothing legally or regulatorily to prevent that from occurring over and over again. And I think that's why we're making a big push at this coming session. We really need to address the systemic issue here and properly regulate oil activities in Florida to make sure that we don't have any unsafe drilling practices. We need all drillers to be accountable, and we need to give them better guidance and standards to make sure that that occurs. So that's going to be the focus of our panel, is to talk about what happened, what we've learned, and what we can take forward in hopefully addressing these issues and protecting our investment for Everglades restoration.
And after that incident I had mentioned, I know that there was groundwater testing that went on after the fact, but there had been concern that it really wasn't enough. The wells they were digging to really test the water weren't deep enough. Is that still a potential concern?
It is. They only tested 13 feet deep, and these chemicals were injected 12,000 feet underground. So obviously that's not where you look for potential contamination. We have been able, through a legal settlement, to get the state to install a deeper groundwater monitoring well. The results are not public yet, but I think that's something we're going to continue to look at, is whether there was any potential contamination occurring or that could occur in the future as a result of what happened, and making sure that we build better practices going forward, that we never have another situation like this again.
I know Fort Myers State Representative Ray Rodriguez had sponsored some legislation specifically regarding regulations for fracking-like techniques. I recall correctly that didn't pass last year. Is that something you're maybe hoping to see come up again this year?
Yes. I mean, Representative Rodriguez had introduced some legislation about information sharing, increasing
yes.
transparency. We're hoping that he'll consider expanding that to also deal with increasing regulatory oversight of the industry and better protections of public safety and better accountability and higher fines and bond requirements for drillers. So really, there's a lot more that needs to be done, but we're working with him and other legislators to address these deficiencies, and we need the public to get engaged and really vocalize that this is an important priority for Southwest Florida, because all of Southwest Florida sits over these oil reserves, and we are seeing renewed interest in expanded oil drilling, including these new fracking-like activities.
As this week marks the 30th annual Everglades Coalition Conference, we're taking a closer look at Everglades restoration efforts. We're speaking with Everglades Coalition Conference National Co-Chair Kara Kapp, along with Jennifer Hecker with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and Don Sheriffs with the Everglades Foundation. You can connect with our guests with your comments and questions. Our phone lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org, or you can follow us on Twitter using hashtag GulfCoastLive. Follow comments coming out of the conference on Twitter using hashtag EVCO2015. And Don Sheriffs, I know you'll be one of the panelists on a discussion looking specifically at restoration of the southern Everglades and Florida Bay. Can you give us an overview of the current conditions of that portion of the Everglades? I understand that this is a region that really highlights some of the restoration efforts that are the furthest along.
Sure. I mean, I think some of the great successes in Everglades restoration, the one-mile bridge that's been completed on Tamiami Trail, are really focused on restoring freshwater flow through the southern part of the system and increasing benefits, particularly in areas like Florida Bay. And so that's really the focus. And as Kara mentioned earlier, the theme of Send It South, you know, we get to the bottom of the system, we can really measure the benefits of our success. To date, the missing piece has been our ability to store water upwards the Everglades agricultural area. And as you mentioned before, the constitutional amendment that was really embraced by Florida voters at 75% this year, specifically outlined acquiring land in the Everglades agricultural area, which we think will be a huge benefit all the way down into Florida Bay and just really give us those salinity levels and habitat restoration benefits that the Everglades desperately need.
All right. And how does climate change come into play when considering restoration for, you know, this most southern portion of the Everglades ecosystem?
You know, at this point, we're 15 years after the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan was signed by Congress and by the state legislature. 15 years ago, nobody was having a conversation about climate change. But what we know and what the National Academy of Sciences has told us is the greatest defense that South Florida communities have against climate change is expediting restoration of America's Everglades. So we have a plan. We are moving forward. We are achieving some successes, but we need to do it faster and better in the next 15 years if we want to deal with the impacts that we're facing in South Florida.
And Jennifer, I know Lake Okeechobee and the Herbert Hoover Dyke are also going to be a topic of a panel discussion there, cleverly titled Beauty and the Beast. But last month, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection announced a 10-year Lake Okeechobee restoration plan aimed at reducing phosphorus nutrient pollution by a third, and that's through a $750 million basin management action plan, they call it. Why is it so important to address nutrient loads in Lake Okeechobee's waters?
Well, I think that a lot of the problems that are felt downstream actually originate from upstream and even north of Lake Okeechobee. So it's very important that we try to restore Lake Okeechobee because many systems, including the Coosachie River, receive water from that lake. I think one of the issues we did have, although we're very pleased that the state moved forward with having a cleanup plan for Lake Okeechobee, it is only for phosphorus, which is only one of the two nutrients. Nitrogen is equally detrimental, especially to coastal ecosystems like our estuary, the Coosachie Estuary. So we had been pushing the state to adopt pollutant limits and a cleanup plan for both nitrogen and phosphorus. And sadly, we're not successful in advocating that and only ended up with phosphorus in it. So controlling nitrogen upstream is going to be a very important issue and a challenge ahead of us if we're going to ever restore the Coosachie River and estuary. Something that we're still pushing for that they do in the future is create a nitrogen basin management action plan for Lake O to try to get at those sources. You know, we really just want source control, controlling this nutrient upstream before it even gets into our waterways, ideally.
And this is numeric nutrient pollution controls is what you're looking for, specific standards.
Standards or what they call a total maximum daily load, which is a pollutant limit for that waterway. So right now, Lake Okeechobee does have one of those pollutant limits, but only for phosphorus, not for nitrogen, which means that nitrogen that's coming into that lake is not being adequately controlled and therefore being allowed to discharge from that lake to our downstream coastal systems where it creates huge algae blooms and problems for us downstream.
Yeah, summer of 2013, for any listeners out there who maybe weren't here then, can you maybe describe what our coastal waters looked like?
Oh, I remember when the Coosahatchee, you couldn't tell where the grass lawn ended and the river began because the river was so green. It was coated entirely in green slime. And that's really a sign of too much nutrient pollution entering our waterways. And while phosphorus is more the problem in freshwater ecosystems, nitrogen becomes the main problem when you're dealing with salty, brackish or saline waters, marine waters. So, you know, that's why we need to control both. They're equally important, and we need our state to take a holistic approach at controlling both of these all the way up from where they're originating from.
And, you know, Jennifer, I know I want to talk about Everglades restoration from an economic standpoint. I know that restoration projects, environmental restoration projects tend to or can get a bad rap as being, you know, very expensive and very time consuming. But when it comes to Everglades restoration, can you tell us about maybe what sort of the return on the investment is going to be if the state and other organizations really do put forth the effort to do what's needed?
Well, there's been economic studies. The Everglades Foundation did one where they looked at an independent group of economists that there was really $4 at least of direct economic benefits in return for every dollar invested in Everglades restoration because it really does increase our water supply, clean up our water. We're a very tourism-based economy that depends on clean, abundant, fresh water. And so Everglades restoration is an environmental project, but it's also one that benefits our water supply and our quality of life here in South Florida. And there are direct economic benefits that outweigh the costs and justify that level of investment that we're making.
And Kara Kapp.
Well, I could expand on that.
Yes, please.
So we saw in 2013, what was called the lost summer of 2013, where incredible amounts of water was discharged from Lake Okeechobee to the Coosachie and the St. Lucie rivers. And we have heard over and over again from realtors that were unable to move family homes in those areas because the waterfront property was covered in green algae and had a distasteful smell. And so these were not just, you know, projected economic benefits. We're actually, by restoring the Everglades, we're preventing significant losses in addition to the jobs that we create, the tourism that we enhance.
All right. Well, we are at the end of the hour, so I am going to have to leave it there. But thanks so much to my guests, Kara Kapp, Jennifer Hecker, and Dawn Sheriffs. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Kara Kapp is National Co-Chair of the 2015 Everglades Coalition Conference and Everglades Restoration Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association. Jennifer Hecker is Director of Natural Resource Policy for the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and a past co-chair of the conference. And Dawn Sheriffs is Senior Everglades Policy Advisor for the Everglades Foundation. Information on this year's conference, including a full program of events, can be found online at evergladescoalition.org/conference.html. There's more information on today's show at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and Luke Martin. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM.